is Saturday, April 28th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. In the first half of Geek Speak, we'll be covering the geek news. In the second half, we'll take your calls with comments about technology, questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that information again in a little bit. And I do want, Miles, you want to do a theme song? It is. Welcome to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We're bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme is by Miles Elam. Have you figured out what you want to ask us about? What you want to call in? Well, you can keep on thinking about that during the show. You can call us anything you like, but please do call in with questions about technology. The phone number, again, is 800-655-5877. And we'll be talking about news first. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is, of course, Mr. Miles Elam. Very nice.
Hi.
Good morning.
Morning. What's your first news? So Miles Elam is a software engineer and political junkie.
Yes, I am. And it kind of goes along with what my first story is going to be about, which is the World War II vet, a 92-year-old gentleman who has pirated 300,000 DVDs.
Wow.
Right. And you think, well, there is...
So, how?
He got a couple of bootleg discs, you know, at Penn Station, bought a DVD duplicator and started duplicating them. Like actual physical discs, not just file sharing.
But sure.
300,000.
Was he selling them?
No. He was packaging them up and sending them for troops in Iraq and Afghanistan to watch.
Has he been busted?
Yes, but at the same time, there's a big question about what to do about this guy. Because from a legal standpoint, it's quite clear what he did.
Yeah.
From a PR standpoint, I don't think the MPAA wants to touch this with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of folks that, including the troops over in Iraq and Afghanistan who receive these discs, that think that he's wonderful, that he is... that he broke monotony, that he gave them a taste of home away from home.
Yeah. Is that sought after quite a bit in Iraq? Films?
The amenities that we find here are not as easily accessible. Yeah. So I'm sure there are movies there. I'm sure they're the same movies over and over again. So a new supply is always welcome.
Yeah, interesting.
Spent about $30,000 of his own money.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Of course, he didn't make any money at all if he's doing that. And it takes a lot of money to burn that many DVDs.
Yes.
How did he do? I mean, physically, how did he do it? That's a lot of DVDs.
Well, it's a duplicator.
How long
it
have you been
seven
doing
copies
it,
at once?
Okay, it's one of those guys. That's cool.
I mean, high speed duplicators, and then mail them out 84 at a time.
And how long did he do it before he got busted? And how did he get busted? You know, it's really curious. I'm wondering if, like, on the packaging that he was printing, he was saying stuff like, hey, thanks for, you know, support from me, and kind of putting his name out there and such. Or if he was doing it,
I'm sure,
quietly
it was
and secretive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't think he was actively trying to hide what he was doing. It just wasn't.
So, you know, I'm assuming he's not in court right now.
Currently, no.
So, and he's a vet of which war?
World War II.
World War II vet, makes a whole bunch of DVD copies, clearly disobeying the FBI warning in the front of the film, and sends 300,000 of them to,
assuming the bootleg copies that he bought still had the FBI warning.
Yeah. Good point. He didn't know. He bought them. When he bought them from the guy on the street, he said, hey, are these copyrighted? And the guy was like, no.
When the studios were asked what they thought of his actions, the first thing they said was, you know, we don't condone his actions. And the Motion Picture Association of America does provide movies to the troops in reel-to-reel format.
Wait, that doesn't make any sense. Reel-to-reel is an audio format. You mean like film format?
No, projector.
Oh, projector. Okay.
Reel-to-reel projector.
Yeah, all right. That's pretty sad. What? What? Do they really send 300,000 films? I don't think so. So it seems to me that it would be easy to produce an environment in which case the film industry would make DVDs and send them. But they're not doing that. Not at his level. grassroots, man. He just did it.
So we'll see how this turns out.
Yeah, it's great. We'll see. All right. I want to talk about 1394. What's that? What is 1394 miles?
That would be the IEEE code for FireWire.
Right. The IEEE Engineering Association of some
sort. Sorry, I-Link, but the trademark name from Apple was FireWire.
Yeah, Apple named it FireWire. It's the protocol that's not USB that's on a lot of devices and computers. Cameras for a long time, video cameras were using this connector to connect video to your computer. And the reason why I bring it up is that one of the things that I constantly am working on, or not working on, but should be working on, is the GeekSpeak website. And we have a lot of articles about things over the years, and of course, hundreds and hundreds of hours of audio and the show notes about them at geekspeak.org if you're interested. And one of the sections which is actually off right now is our articles section, but the URLs are still available. You just can't find them very easily. And one of the things we have is an article about FireWire. When it first came out, Sean wrote a big article about FireWire, or he saw it and used the logo or something like that in an article. And the logo he uploaded was this very large FireWire logo. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, other people decided that on their forums and such, when talking about FireWire, using it would just link to our image. So we have a lot of traffic from FireWire. We had to turn that off after a while. But
I remember putting in that Apache rewrite rule.
That's right.
Unless it's...
No more serving.
Yeah, if it comes from some other domain.
So the thing that I found so interesting is that FireWire is, of course, kind of dying. It's kind of going away. And it will be gone within 5 years, I would say. So we saw the birth of FireWire on GeekSpeak and its complete life cycle within our show time. That was kind of interesting. One of the things I was listening to a security show I love called Security Now with Steve Gibson. And he was talking about FireWire because it has memory access, direct memory access in the bus. Mm-hmm. If you have a machine running, even if you have we were talking last night about encrypting your hard drive, the entire hard drive is encrypted. And the way that works is when your machine boots up, that password is entered in or found in the hardware, whatever way you mm-hmm. manage it. And then the file system at that point now can access the hard drive totally unencrypted. It doesn't look like it's encrypted. It's accessing, mm-hmm. it's kind of hidden to the operating system. So that encryption key has to exist somewhere in RAM. And so if you have a running machine that's working, even if it's an encrypted hard drive, and you plug in a FireWire dongle that has some nifties in it, it can just access that encryption key, and you can then use it later, right? So it's a kind of a security hole from a physical computing perspective. Mm-hmm. And so he was suggesting turn it off. No one uses it anymore. You probably don't use it anymore. And I thought, yeah, no one is using it. I use FireWire still because FireWire 800 on the current laptop I have is the fast mm-hmm. bus speed for hard drive access. It's faster than the USB port. But the next Macs won't have it. Windows machines have always been problematic.
Or they would have a Thunderbolt 2 FireWire adapter.
Yeah, right. Thunderbolt's the new hotness in fast access. So FireWire, complete life cycle on GeekSpeak. That was kind of neat. I mean, it's still around, of course.
So that's what, and a lot of people, they can, pry it from their whole dead hands.
Like, I love the FireWire interface.
There's a lot of devices out there that are FireWire based,
yeah,
including the original iPod.
That's right. The original iPod's FireWire 400. And, the FireWire standard, it's got a 12-volt power supply alongside it. And so it was it had more power use than USB. So there were actually pretty big breakout boards for sound cards and other things that ran off the FireWire bus. At the same time, you can kill the FireWire bus with a long enough FireWire cable. I speak from experience at work, unfortunately, where I've done that. I bought some 50-foot FireWire cables, and I think they have a note on them in a drawer somewhere that says, if you use this, it will break your FireWire port. Not totally sure if that's true, but at least the warning is there.
Nice.
Your next story, sir?
Actually, I wanted to bring up a little anecdote I'm sure would be fun for people to hear about. Because we were talking about that image, a FireWire image that was being used by everyone.
Yeah, so our web server hosted this great FireWire logo. And it was really high resolution with a white background. And other people just used it in their page.
Yeah, which means that it was link jacking.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what we did was simply turn it off, like have it so that if it looked like it was coming from another site, like some site, other site was trying to host that image in their page, you can find that out through your
HTTP
in your server, your server headers, yeah, and or rather from the client headers coming into the server. And so I just turned it off. I think I made it like a access denied error or something like that, but it brought to mind many different ways that people combat this, because we did it in a very unimaginative, very straightforward way. Some other folks will do things like if you're trying to do a link jack, if you're trying to host an image that you don't own off of somebody else's website, because taking the image and putting it on your own website is one thing. That's a copyright infringement. Taking the image that someone else owns and embedding it in your own site means that you're not only violating copyright, but you're also using up the bandwidth from the other person. The other person has to pay for your site.
Wait a second. Why would you say it's copyright infringement? You're not actually ever hosting the file. All you're doing is saying, by the way, this file over there exists.
No, on the contrary. Because you are the web page is your own presentation.
Okay.
It's considered one, you know, thing, something coming from your domain, coming from your page. You are responsible for that coming out, unless you're a common carrier like YouTube.
Okay, Miles, this gets really complicated because, of course, if you put up a website and in the page there's a link to the image, that's not copyright infringement, right?
But people who would like to make it thus, but
right.
As far as I'm aware,
so let's say I write an article and I say, hey, we've been hosting a Firewire image for a long time, and link of Firewire actually goes to the Wikipedia entry. I'm not responsible for the copyright over there. If I then embed all the Wikipedia content onto my page, now I'm copying their content over. Of course, that's okay with Wikipedia because it's Creative Commons, but we won't get into that. But isn't it true that the actual document that I am sending around is just an instruction set on what you could do? If you're using a text reader, you're not going to see that image embedded or that
website
embedded.
Right, but this is not saying an instruction set for possible things you could do. This is an instruction set for specific actions. It isn't a, here's a link available that you could click on.
What about this?
You go
what
to
about
our
a header?
Site and this will be coming up.
Okay, then what about a header of JavaScript at the top of the page, a little active link at the top of the page, that when you click it, it then does embed those links content in there. But in the warning, it says, you are actually doing this, not me. You know what I'm saying? Like the onus of who's actually creating that page.
I'm not going to touch the legality of that. I would say that the user experience on that is going to be pretty atrocious.
Yeah.
Another thing that comes up is Wi-Fi. Because people will steal Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're using someone else's Wi-Fi connection,
it
for free.
Don't use the term steal Wi-Fi. Use Wi-Fi without permission.
Use Wi-Fi without permission. Okay. But at the same time, there's a lot of folks who don't have the technical savvy to know how to lock their system down. Or they just don't. They're like, hey, my router's working. I'm not going to mess with it.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
And... are you having growing pains from that setup I left behind?
No, your setup is awesome. No, other places.
But when you have, you know, even if you have it open and then suddenly everyone in the apartment building next to you has decided like, oh, yeah, this you can totally use this. This is just fine. Suddenly everyone is using it for YouTube and Netflix and stuff like that. And suddenly you can't use your own internet connection. Well, one way you could do that is put a password on it and blocking all access. Another thing you could do if you have the sufficient time and energy and, you know, I guess technical avarice.
Yes.
Is set it up that you have a HTTP proxy in between that internet connection, between them coming in your router gateway and then going out to the internet, so that all images that they try to get from any site get translated to be upside down or like reverse color.
Very nice.
Because these are things you can do. They take some CPU time.
Assuming, of course, they're not using HTTPS.
Right, which case you could just block it.
But yeah. So what you're saying is that's the open Wi-Fi you want to do is just a translated mess with people. How about just add advertising for some business so you make money on it on the side? So the Wi-Fi access point, really interesting. I just want to see. I remember another thing that's happened during the lifespan of GeekSpeak. John, Tracy, and I used to commute down together to the show. And one time while he was driving, I popped open my laptop to see how many access points. And I remember driving down Ocean Street in downtown Santa Cruz and going, and by the end of it, you know, from Ocean's got a pretty defined length, right? Mm-hmm. So from the start to the end of Ocean Street, I had 11 access points. And we were like, oh my gosh. And we were like amazed. Wow. Because, you know, within a couple miles of Santa Cruz, 11 access points and like five of them were open. Oh my gosh. And just a totally new world. We're really amazed by that. Right now in the studio, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 at this location.
And only two of them are with KOSP, right?
Only two are KOSPs. And, of course, we're in a shared building. There's quite a few people. There's Black Panda. I love the bacon, bacon, bacon is one of the access points. and the two open access points of all those are locked except for two of them, and the two that are open are actually secondaries of ones that are primaries, right? So there's a name and then there's a slash guest on two of them.
So it's probably one of those airport extremes that has a
guest way of doing it.
Yeah,
right.
One that doesn't allow access to the local network.
Right, right. So that's pretty kind of cool. So basically, they're giving away a little bit of that. Of course, it might be something else where you have to log in at some point. But wireless access has definitely exploded. I keep a wireless access open at home.
Yeah, and how close are your neighbors?
A ways away.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
But the thing that's tricky about that, of course, is that if someone does start infringing copyright at like a major level and starts sharing a whole bunch of content or downloading or sending 300,000 DVDs, but they got the copy through their network and they're using your open access point, you're liable, right? Or you could be sued, and how do you fight that?
That's still an open debate that's
but
going
But that's
on
the thing
the
is, you might
you
get...
Are, yeah, yeah, there are people who have been...
It's not uncommon for a company to do a lawsuit at like that $1,500 rate where it's not worth it to fight it, so you just pay it. Mm-hmm. And that's based on IP address of use. And if you're the one that the ISP is giving the connection to, you're responsible. So you got to think about that. Should we move on to other news, sir?
Yes.
Please do.
Sure. SSL. This is what is being used. Actually, TLS, I should say, is what's being used.
We all call it SSL now. I think it's okay to do that.
Whenever you put in HTTPS, you should be seeing that HTTPS every time you're putting your credit card information or personal information into a site. But that's
Google and Facebook are basically enforcing it now.
Right,
and you have to use it if you're using any kind of banking things. Absolutely, it's ridiculous not to.
You have to do it for any type of transaction.
Yeah, really.
In fact, it should just be for every site.
And, also, when you log into any site, if it doesn't have SSL, if it doesn't have the HTTPS thing, then you're just giving the password around to anyone around. Like, it's just like taking your password, writing on a piece of paper, and handing it out to anyone around you. Anyway, SSL.
Has a vulnerability, or at least SSL implementations at most of the top sites and a lot of the not top sites.
Go on.
This is known as the Beast SSL attack. And it really does call into question the security of this backbone of internet transactions. Well, it found out that of the top sites, 75% of them are vulnerable to this attack. And just 10% of the surveyed sites should be considered actually secure because they've done patches or they have an alternate SSL implementation.
What is the Beast attack?
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay, well, I'll plug my ears and you tell everybody else.
And this was done by a group called the SSL Pulse Project. And so if they were gathering data on 200,000 sites. So 90% of those sites need to be updating their SSL implementation. And some of this is not necessarily the site's fault per se, because some distributions have been slow to update their packages.
Are we talking about an open SSL implementation problem, or are we talking about a key generation problem?
It is. Oh, that's a fine question.
Because what the lacking that I've heard is a couple of different stories out there about this. I believe one of them is that the general idea is that you have to use a very large random number to generate your SSL certs to then get signed by a company. And if two companies somehow get the same generated seed, they could potentially get the same cert set. And then it's not safe, because if you have the same cert as me, there's a collision problem. Mm-hmm. And one of the cases I heard was that there was a large survey and there was actually a lot more collisions than you would hope, which means that more people actually had paired. Now, unless you knew one side of that, you couldn't do anything. But if you happen to be, the paired with some other company that had a cert that was going, you could encrypt and decrypt their information and actually sign stuff as them. But that was one of the case I heard. The other thing, of course, has to do with a, open SSL implementation problem. That it's an open source project. It gets changed all the time. So if you know more about the details of it, I'd love to hear. While you're doing a little bit of reading on that, I will go ahead and mention that GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by, supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish and using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. Learn more online at RamirezDDS.com. Everything we talk about in GeekSpeak, we take notes on and provide links to the original source that we read at We do that on geekspeak.org. That was really horrible.
Good
English.
Set.
Thank you. In the studio with me is Miles Elam. And answering the phones in the other room is Rick Philman. Rick is ready to take your calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. 800-655-5877. Details of the beast attack, Mr. Miles Elam?
Yeah, no one cares.
Okay, good, fine. Geekspeak on Curious
If you care, you can always look it up and read the paper.
Do you have a geek bit? You got a geek bit?
Sure. Movies, usually not very good at showing computers and technology in their
atrocious. Except for the Matrix was pretty good. She hacked the Matrix.
Well,
she used a backdoor. It was pretty valid. She was too fast, but still.
But yeah. I mean, yeah. One thing in computer science that that comes up for people early on in their education is the traveling salesman problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you have a salesman needs to go to all these different cities. What is the shortest path?
Without going through a city twice. And that is computationally very difficult.
Yes. It is referred to as a NP-complete problem. Non-deterministic polynomial time complete problem. And a polynomial time meaning, you know, you can say, given a certain number of assets to deal with, how long your algorithm is going to take. You can
right.
give it a range. You can.
This is when we say n minus one and that kind of terminology on GeekSpeak. That's what we're talking about.
O of n, O log n.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And keep in mind, if you're interested in this, go into computer science as your major in college. Go on.
Well, there is a movie coming out, and it's called Traveling Salesman.
Okay.
And it's about the traveling salesman problem. And the P versus NP problem, which is right now there's an open question as to whether or not polynomial time and non-deterministic polynomial time or deterministic versus non-deterministic are actually equal. Like, can you find a deterministic algorithm for a what is considered an NP complete problem?
Oh.
And most people think no, but they haven't proven it yet.
It's actually very hard to prove. I love those problems in math.
Right.
And the proof is actually difficult.
So what this thriller is about is what happens if P is equal to NP, which means that cryptography?
No more longer.
Screwed.
Right.
And
this is one of the threats, if you will, you can put it that term, of quantum computers, is that it's possible with enough qubits that you would potentially get to that point. Why is this a thriller?
Well, because it's talking about the world's four smartest mathematicians hired by the U.S. government to solve the most elusive problem in computer history, and whether or not it leads to an advancement in humanity or downfall of society, and you end up with the power plays that go along, because this is
wiping out
a lot of money involved and a lot of people and resources.
One of the foundations we talk about, like when we were talking about SSL, that the reason it works has to do with these mathematical problems that are extremely difficult to solve. And that is the way we prove for that, basically, is by talking about it. This algorithm is such that it takes this long to figure it out. Therefore, you know, till the universe is ended, you're safe with the amount of processing power that exists currently on the planet. That kind of math all is based on looking at how algorithms are solved.
Right.
And so if that fundamentally changed.
Very large prime numbers.
Yeah. And if that fundamentally changed, this concept of that changed, it would completely, it would drastically change how encryption works. It wouldn't work anymore, basically. And therefore, all transactions, all everything would be transparent and kind of a different world we would live in. Which, I got to say, is not necessarily, well, it's an interesting problem, definitely. Hey, GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Cruz.io Works, rentable workspaces located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz, featuring 40 new private offices, meeting rooms, an organic cafe, 100 megabits per second Wi-Fi. More information at cruzio.com/CruzIO Works, or just give them a call, 459-6301. We are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. We can answer any questions you have, and we'd love to hear your comments about what we've spoken about today. I won't give out the phone numbers because, of course, we are already full of phone lines, but I will in a few minutes in case you can jump in.
We've been that controversial already.
I guess so.
I think we were that bad.
Or
today.
It sounds to everyone that we need more help. And,
it's more, that's far more likely.
It's much more likely. Well, let's see what's... What's going on from Hal in Santa Cruz? Hal, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning. Two questions. A quick one when you're talking about our Wi-Fi. If it's password protected, aren't we adequately protected?
If you have to log in with a password to get access to your Wi-Fi, at least the first time, and then after that it memorizes it, the answer is kind of yes.
Well, yeah, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is, well, it depends on whether or not you're using WEP, WPA, WPA2, how long your password is.
If you have a more recent...
Which one is best?
Okay, WPA or WPA2 is...
WPA2. Do not use WPA.
WPA2 is the protocol you want. How long your password's important. If you just have a one-letter password, someone could guess it. What I suggest people to do with their Wi-Fi, I do this all the time, is use it something that everybody knows that visits your house. A home phone number is a great one for that, for your Wi-Fi access, right? So now you're using your home password and your home phone number. Your neighbors could potentially know it, right, because they know you. But anyone that kind of associates your address and your home phone number, probably that's okay. It's not a bad thing. I guess if everyone did it, it'd be bad. But it's an easy way to solve that problem. The other thing you can do is just, you know, use your favorite radio show name, right? Real simple, like GeekSpeak, and that's your password. That would always work.
Okay. My other question, I was looking on the web I have a program called Visual Route that tells me all the hops on my way to some URL or website that I'm going to.
A graphical version of Traceroute. Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. And I found that Skype, when I looked for Skype.com, it was 14 hops and I ended up in Estonia. And I thought that was kind of strange. And so I did a little more Googling around, and I found a post where someone said that the way Skype does it, they say, you know, Google has this whole set of server farms and acres and acres of servers. Skype doesn't have them. Skype uses your computer. And when you agree to Skype's terms, you're letting them use your computer as one of their servers.
No, that's not how it works. It's actually much more wonderful than that. It's actually not scary. It's basically this idea. Traditionally, the way you've made a phone call, if me and Miles make a phone call, we actually...
Miles and I.
Thank you. If Miles and I... You know what? I'm not calling Miles. I'm going to call somebody else. So, Hal, if you and I are having a phone call, traditionally, there's actually a few places in between that actually can listen in. Like, the traditional phone operator person actually patches in, and that person could actually listen right there. And that would be kind of equivalent to a server hosting our conversation. Skype actually makes a connection point to point. So when you and I make a phone call to each other, we connect through Skype to find out where we are. Then when we actually dial, our computers talk to each other directly. It's a much more secure way of doing it, actually. Now, Microsoft now owns Skype, and Microsoft also has a patent on how to make it not work that way. And they would basically provide, if this patent is actually being done right now, I don't know if they've implemented it in Skype, where you would initiate a phone call with me and I'd initiate a phone call with you. But if somebody else wanted to be a part of it, they would say, actually, you know what, quietly to anybody else, we're going to have Skype make the conversation through us and we're going to listen the entire time. But right now, it's using your computer in the sense that there's no server involved at all, which is actually how you want communication to be.
Unless there's a conference call going on, in which case you're...
Then it's a little
you're
more complicated.
Probably based upon the person who initiated the conference.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so let me give you some data that kind of reinforced what I thought was going on. I have a T1 connection through AT&T, a lot of very bad, very old copper, and AT&T has been working on it for weeks trying to fix it. But my connection's very erratic, and my ISP acknowledges that.
Okay.
So I decided to turn Skype off and watch the pings. I can use Traceroute every 5 seconds and watch the pattern. And all of a sudden, my connection got so much cleaner.
Okay, so do this for me. Do a little Google search on buffer bloat and look into that. What's going on is home routers and any routers have too much buffer space because memory is so cheap. What happens is the buffer stack, when you have a lot of data being filling it, fills that buffer stack, and it actually breaks the way TCP/IP is supposed to work. I won't get into detail on that because we have other calls to take, but definitely research buffer bloat.
Although the route to Estonia has me a little worried.
Buffer bloat. Mm-hmm. Router buffer.
BLOAT.
Google will figure it out for you, but yeah.
Okay. Yes, it is BLOAT.
Yeah, thank you so much, Hal.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, the route to Estonia does have me a little concerned because you shouldn't be routed.
Well, if the phone call was to Estonia.
If it's to Estonia, sure. Yeah. But I mean, I'm getting the sense from that it wasn't.
Routing's much more complicated than we all give it credit to before. You know, it's not like right now at your, I mean, do a trace route at home to a few places you know where they exist, right? Do a trace route to Cruz IO, do a trace route to UCSC. You know where they are, and you'll be surprised where you actually, how you do that. How your machine does.
Well, that's the thing. I'm pretty sure it will bump me over to like San Jose.
Yeah, and try like Delaware. I mean, it's just crazy. Really? Yeah, it goes all over the place, and I'm not really sure why. So AT&T's, you're gonna probably. Do you have a Comcast?
Yes.
I think you're gonna hop up to San Francisco before you go down, but I'm not sure. We will keep on taking phone calls. I think that makes sense. Does that make sense, Miles?
Yeah.
Okay. Totally. Phew. From Santa Cruz, JC, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good.
Okay, my interface with you guys is talking about us as individual people and the interface of computer mechanisms relative to the automobile.
Okay.
And what it has to do with is I was listening to something in Henry Ford, Ford, whatever. He was talking about a few different mechanisms, which looks like it ties in with Google and the ability to control the position of the car relative to other things. And they have a vision where they want the position of your car relative to other cars in the given area, but then also projecting out into your future space, let's say 5 miles down the road, oh, there's a storm there. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to deal with wet weather as well as traffic backing up and things of that nature. I happen to like the ability to be able to gauge that myself pushing down on the brake and things of mm-hmm. that nature.
Well, what you're talking about is cars enhanced with artificial intelligence to assist in driving. And we're seeing them in the road. Yep. There are Google driving vehicles, non-human controlled vehicles in Arizona, right?
No, Nevada.
Nevada. Yes.
Nevada. And they are in California as well, but they have a human being sitting in the seat.
Right, kind of to take over potentially if a fault happens or something unexpected happens. But I got to say that with the amount of death that happens in the United States because of car accidents, if we could improve that, let's say we could half the death and injury rate. Let's say we could drop it down to one quarter of what it currently is. Would you give up that freedom? Because that's the real question is, if we got to the point where the cars could drive better than us, and if you let all the cars be controlled by computers, assuming there's not some giant computer car overlord takeover, but during that free time where they're getting power over society, all of a sudden we're dying less, we have less injuries, isn't that a better world?
It could be, except what about the glitch that comes into play?
Well, that's the fear.
And you get a pile up of multiple cars.
Absolutely. That fault issue is definitely a problem. Now, humans glitch too. You hear about pileups currently all the time, right? So humans are actually very distractible. They don't do the kind of patient attentions that a car would have. I'd almost rather a sensor in the system of the car that determines if the human's paying attention and gives feedback to them to improve the driver. I think that would probably be a quicker and easier way to do it because that's just, you know, a camera watching you and maybe a blood cuff and maybe a clip on the ear and a probe of some size. You know, there's just a few things you have to do to human to find out if they're actually paying attention. And then if you disable the car or slow it down or give a warning every time the person starts paying attention to their phone call or paying attention to their kids in the back seat, that would actually make safer drivers. That's probably cheaper than to roboticize every vehicle in the United States.
Except that a lot of people are easily startled. And startled people behind the wheel is not necessarily a good thing.
You don't want the computer from, I don't think you should turn that way, Dave. I don't know. I think
suddenly you start decelerating when you didn't plan on it as you were turning around, like yelling at your kids. You're like, whoa, wait a second. Ah!
Yeah, but right now, you know, they spill the apple juice and you crash.
That's a sport in driving. Anyway, second part is they were talking about reserving a parking spot.
Yes.
So that let's say you want to go to such and such a place at this particular point in time and you have your parking spot reserved.
Yep. You know, the reason I don't like that idea is that the people with the high-tech stuff and lots of money get all the cool parking spots. That's not fair.
Right, because that doesn't happen now.
But that already happens with driving. You know, you get a speed pass. What do they call it? Speed passes in California?
Easy pass.
You get one of those. You have to have a little bit of money and financial backing to get one of those. And and they pay the monthly fee, and then you get to drive better on public roads. And, of course, more money comes in. I mean, there's a lot of benefits from these. I don't find it that disturbing. I mean, right now, you know that you're a Santa Cruz person. You know in Santa Cruz all the parking meters. You can pay with that with your phone via an app. And you don't have to actually put money in it. And you potentially, I mean, I don't think you can reserve it. I don't know if they know when what's are empty. But I don't know. It's not that upsetting to me. And besides, I can't stand trying to find parking. I want to be able to park. I would love my phone to be able to tell me where the parking spots were.
That's the sport of it, though.
Okay. Oh, well. I'm glad you like the sport. JC, thanks for the call.
You guys have a good day.
Take care.
Thank you.
From Watsonville, PB, hi, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there. Hello?
Hello, what's your question today?
I have a MacBook, and the trackpad part works fine, but the selector part has slowly gone dead over the last several months.
The button below it, the pushing of it?
Yeah.
Is it so? This is a trackpad with a button below it?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I got the computer, I should tell you, from my best friend who's got a brand new one, so she gave me her old one.
That's an awesome way to get a computer.
It's a hand-me-down, right. But she has two big dogs who shed a lot.
Yeah, there's probably hair in there.
Yeah, I'm just wondering.
Every story I hear about someone trying to fix this problem, they make it worse. So be careful of that aspect. I'm going to give you one quick. There's two workarounds that are really easy. You can plug a mouse into your laptop. Mice are pretty awesome. You can plug in a trackpad. You can do a Bluetooth trackpad. Totally remove the, you know, ignore the hardware problem completely and just bypass it.
Right. I already did that.
Okay. And the other thing you can do with the trackpad is OS X actually allows for a single and double tap with your fingers on the trackpad itself, but you have to enable it. So go into the preferences and enable that. Now, if you want to try to fix this problem, it does require you to take the laptop apart. And then still, the actual trackpad might need to be replaced. The button might need to be replaced.
What?
Because Apple is really, really good at making small, tiny things that are just at the point where you can't fix them.
Do you know which of the preferences lets you do the double tap?
Well, go to mouse. Go to
system preferences, and then mouse trackpad.
Accessibility?
Yeah.
No, not accessibility.
You should have under hardware, you should have a thing that says trackpad.
Oh, okay.
And it's going to be different. It's going to be different in every version of the OS and each hardware solution. So, like the MacBook that I've got in front of me actually has multi-touch on the pad. Yours probably doesn't. So it's going to be a little different. So I can't tell you exactly what it is, but that's where you want to look. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We are now speaking with Elizabeth in Aptos. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there, guys.
Hi.
I like that last week you were talking about vomit, and this week it's bloat. Great. So I have a question about, you mentioned the Wi-Fi issue, and we are password protected here, but we are constantly losing our connection. It just goes out all the time, and so...
Does it go out completely, or does it take a long time?
It goes... I'm not sure what you're asking.
So when you say it goes out completely, what do you do to remedy that? Do you wait?
Just have to wait.
How long?
Like a minute, or sometimes it just keeps doing it.
How old is your wireless device?
How old is the wireless?
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't know. A few years.
And also, how many people do you have using it?
Yeah.
Two people. And I actually had AT&T come out and look at it, and they said the wires in our house, like, we should replace the wire that goes to it. But I just wondered, when I heard you talking about people, you know, using your Wi-Fi and downloading. I mean, I'm assuming other people can't use ours if we're password protected, but the thing that is baffling to me is that this issue is about 10 times worse on the weekend, I've noticed.
So when you're in your home and you look at your Wi-Fi, you know, choices, are there a lot of choices around you?
There's about 7, I would say. I live in a condominium, but it's a small, there's 10 condominiums here.
I think it's because there are a lot of other routers around, and the reason we're having a problem on the weekend is everyone else is using their Wi-Fi link, and you're getting some interference.
Yeah. And there's a couple other things. If it's completely dying, unfortunately, because of entropy and such, the machine actually makes a lot of heat, and it has to be dissipated for it to work. And the more you use it, the more heat it makes. And the more problems it has with trying to connect, that means the antenna's on more, the more heat it's producing. So the first thing you can do that would be nice is take that device and try to knock the dust out of it and vacuum it. Now, I wouldn't necessarily open it up, but That's one thing to do.
You mean the modem? Or?
The modem, the wireless access point. It's probably a cable modem, AT&T modem, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing is to go into its settings and make sure you choose as the channel automatic. And the reason for that is it will use, there's six different channels in the Wi-Fi spectrum. This is unregulated band, right? So they can all compete with
six,
each other.
I thought we were doing that.
Is it 12?
No, it's 11, actually.
Yeah. There you go. We don't know.
Yeah.
Miles knows and I don't.
I figured you guys don't really know anything.
That's right. So what you want to do is
well sometimes.
You want to let it choose automatically what channel it uses. That
okay.
way, if it sees a lot of traffic on a different channel, it can do that. Now, these channels are not just beautiful empty spaces that don't collide. They can collide. And there's uh-huh. other things around that can collide, too. Your neighbor might have a phone that's in the same spectrum as the Wi-Fi. And whenever
uh-huh.
they use the phone, you lose your connection.
Mm-hmm.
So Wi-Fi, as Wi-Fi gets denser and denser, becomes less and less easy. Do
mm-hmm.
you agree with that, Miles?
Yes, it's 2.4 gigahertz. In other words, the exact same frequency as many cordless phones and also, strangely enough, your microwave.
Mm-hmm.
That's the frequency mm-hmm. that microwaves run on. And
right.
so the reason why cordless phones use this and why Wi-Fi use this spectrum is because it's unregulated.
Right.
So anyone could put anything they wanted on there
mm-hmm.
as long as it didn't.
If we didn't do it that way, if you want a Wi-Fi in your home, you'd have to apply the FCC to get a license for the brand, for the band.
Right. But and that's why many Wi-Fi routers now have a dual mode, so a 5 gigahertz as well
yeah.
as a 2.4.
I would recommend, I mean, I'm in this space where a little bit more information about what's going on around me is a good way to figure this out. But do change it to automatic. And then if it really is when other people are using bandwidth, there's not much you can do about the collision problem.
Mm.
If somebody's got a bad wireless access point that's spewing out nasty handshaking protocol whenever it tries, your machine's going to respond to it. The other Wi-Fi access, it just becomes this rat's nest of pain. I kind of wish apartment
yeah,
managers...
like that sometimes, trying to do something that should take 5 minutes, it takes an hour.
Yeah.
But the thing you mentioned in the beginning of the show about HTTPS
yep.
doing like an upside down, that wouldn't matter if I have password protection.
That's talking about something completely.
Yeah, having password protected on your Wi-Fi, as long as you're using WPA2, which is what you should be using, is really not something people can crack. You'll be okay.
Yeah. One thing that would work
just
for you, unfortunately,
would be a
fairly large outlay of
capital.
Would be making your condominium into a Faraday cage.
I don't think that's going to help her at all.
It would block out any outside interference coming in, and then all she sees is the end, whatever.
You could also elicit some magical fairies to help you.
Hey, no.
Yeah.
Even if you got in the direction of them, it would block out.
Do you know what it means to do a Faraday cage around your house? It just isn't practical.
What, you take a whole bunch of aluminum foil and you put it on the ceiling?
What if I wore an aluminum hat?
I think Miles is about to wear an aluminum hat. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye, Elizabeth.
Bye.
Hey, man, you get a solid sheet of metal.
You always suggest Faraday cage. It's not as simple as that. Sounds good, though.
Really? Putting a sheet of metal wouldn't block.
It would help the other signals. But then you'd actually have multipath problems of your own Wi-Fi inside that space.
Right, and you wouldn't be able to use your cell phone inside.
Yeah, and there'd be that, too. It's just not a good solution. From Ben Lohman, Sarah, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello, thank you for picking me up.
Certainly. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah. Well, before I ask my question, I kind of have to tell you a little story.
Okay.
I work, I'm at a terminal where another employee previously had her IT account.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently she had it set to remember her password. So every time I open iTunes, it opens up with her account.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to put some music on my iPhone. So I signed out and signed back in with my password.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite look right, but I went ahead and put loaded up the music and plugged in my iPhone and synced it. And I ended up getting reset all of my settings. I lost all of my contacts.
Of your phone.
Mm-hmm. Because it turned into her phone, basically.
Yeah. All you do is take your phone back to your main machine at home and sync again.
Well, unfortunately, we have 3 iPhones at home, so I don't know which one
to recover from.
Synced.
Yeah.
You know, it should. Did you try it already, or did it say choose which one?
Well, I actually called the Apple store, and they sent me to the cloud, where fortunately I had loaded my contacts. So I was able to rescue my contacts from there.
Uh-huh.
But I just went and reset everything on my phone.
Okay. But so if you resync your phone to your iTunes, original iTunes, you should be able to do a recover. And I don't think the recover is going to work from any other phone but yours.
But that, so, that only works
if you
have
the cloud, why?
Well, it's not syncing from the cloud, the music, necessarily.
That only works if I had previously synced my iPhone to my home computer, which I had not done.
Oh. Oh. That's a completely different environment. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, right. I was taking on the assumption that you had some computer somewhere that actually you normally sync your phone to.
No.
So you did it for the first time to that other machine.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, there's no way to really recover from that.
Well, there is always starting up iTunes for on that computer and assigning it for your username.
So
how do I do that? I tried to do
okay,
that,
what you
but
really,
I couldn't do
the,
that.
The easiest way to do it is completely erase the preferences files for iTunes. Is it a Mac or a Windows machine?
It's a Mac.
Okay. So what you want to do is completely erase any of the settings for iTunes. I mean, personally, if I was the IT person at that environment, I would have set up a new account for you on that computer, and then iTunes would have started fresh. And then if you're an admin, you could do like a search for all MP3 files on the computer, and it would actually search into the other directory, and then you'd get those music files, though that would be copyright infringement potentially. And then your iTunes would be your local copy for your user account, and you'd be set.
Yeah, I was also thinking, actually, luckily you are calling in with a question that does not have any shady legality associated with it, which we have some calls in saying, how do I get my MP3s from my... anyway, so
I would make a new
account. You should be eligible just to go to the Apple Store to the Genius Bar and have them walk you through it.
Yeah, you've got a relatively new phone.
So is there a way to get just what you want from your iTunes account rather than syncing resetting everything?
Yeah, what you need to do is you need to plug in your machine to your iTunes account and then stop it from doing what it's doing. The first thing it's going to do is try to do a backup of your app, of your phone. And you stop, and there's a whole menu. If you select on the left-hand side the iPhone that you're interested in, the one you've connected, and you click on it, and then you start looking through all the different tabs, you can do a lot of changes in settings. You can choose what music of there you want to sync. It has a lot of control. But definitely do that.
Oh, you can.
What's that?
You can do that. Okay.
So when you connect your phone, though, when you connect your phone, it might start syncing automatically.
Yeah.
So what you want to do is try to stop that from happening. Once you plug in the phone, it'll show up on the left-hand side in iTunes. You select it, and then you'll have a whole lot of choices. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.
Should we try to take one more call?
Oh, certainly.
All right.
We got plenty of time.
Yeah. 6 minutes? Sure. From Santa Cruz, Lynn, welcome to Geek Speak. Wait, yes.
Yes.
Yes, hi.
Hi. My computer, or rather my email, was hacked 2 days ago, and I lost the current inbox and all of the sent mail, all of the drafts. It's an iMac. And yet the email that was sent out to my whole contact list, about 100 people, stated that if anyone wanted to help me financially in Manila, where I was stranded and couldn't pay my hotel bill, where I'm not, I happen to be born in Manila, but that's aside, they at the very end of it, they say, please let me know if you can help us out, write me back so that I can tell you how to get it to me. That would mean that my current email is in their hands and not in mine. I don't quite understand how they expect to benefit.
What's the domain name? Do you access your email through a web interface?
Yes.
Okay.
Yahoo.
Through Yahoo. Okay, so they actually got access to your Yahoo account.
Yes.
And currently probably have access, and you might not have access.
Yes.
Also, when you say reply to me, is there a link down at the bottom that you're supposed to click on in this email that goes out to everybody? That might not be your email address. It might be somebody else's email address.
Well, it was sent to me by my attorney who got the message. I did not obviously get the message.
Mm-hmm.
The inbox was shut down. There was nothing further in it that morning, and I looked at it at 4
right.
o'clock, hours later. I took it into a local Apple service person where it still is, so I can't answer any question further.
Okay. Well, the thing you want to do is you want to log into your Yahoo account if you can. If you remember your password, and the password hasn't been changed.
I had to change it immediately.
Yeah, and change the password immediately. And then any incoming email will go to you. Now, the other thing you want to do is make sure when you do change the password to the Yahoo account, then look into the preferences of the Yahoo web interface to see if there's any forwarding happening. Because it's very possible they'll forward a copy of every email to this other address.
So I can ask the Apple person to do that. I don't know how to do that in preferences.
It's not in the preferences of your computer. It's in preferences of the Yahoo Mail. You could do this right now from somebody else's computer if you know your username and password for
Run
Yahoo.
Run that by me again.
Sure. Yahoo is completely a web interface, which means you can go from any web browser in the world, can go to yahoo.com, click on the mail links, type in your email address and the password that hopefully you still have, and then you will actually be accessing your mail through a web interface. In that application, that web application, it's just a web page, there will be a preferences, and you can go look through that and change it. Any kind of geek can help you with this.
Yes.
I'd highly recommend getting someone you know to sit with you to kind of walk through this. You do not need your computer. Your computer is actually probably completely your computer is probably not a part of this at all. Because there's only like one Trojan that's been out in the wild, and as long as you've been updating from Apple, maybe you didn't update in Apple in time. It's most likely the way they got access almost always is the password is something that was guessable and they guessed it. Or they tricked you by sending you an email. You clicked on it, logged into Yahoo, but you weren't really logging into Yahoo. You were logging into them.
Yeah.
And that's a good trick for them to get your password as well. But if your password is something guessable, like it's a pet name or an animal name or a birthday.
No, it was very complicated.
It was very complicated.
Several, cases.
Yeah. The thing is, a password that's anything, shorter than six is not complicated enough. But
one quick public service announcement out there. This is a common scam. It's been around for years.
Yes.
So everyone who's listening out there, if you get an email...
Even those people that aren't listening.
Yeah, that seems like it's coming from a friend, and they're stranded. I've heard variations like, I'm stranded in London. This one is stranded in Manila.
Call them.
Call the person. And two, take it with a very, very large grain of salt.
Yeah, it's not true. And it's not true for a few reasons. Yeah. You probably wouldn't be the person that contact you. The person that they would contact would be someone that knows exactly what their itinerary is. So if you're surprised that they were even in Manila, then you're the wrong person for them to call.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a big... I hope that your friends are wise enough not to send money off to this.
Yeah, and they know that I write literally. The grammatical stuff isn't mine.
Right. Yeah. The grammar will trick them.
Yeah.
See, the next generation, my kid's generation, I don't know if the grammar will help anybody figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well. I think they know more than we know.
This actually reminds me of a whole problem with email that we never really know where it's coming from. The idea that we assume an email is coming from a certain person because it's from your account is just not good enough nowadays. And it's a serious problem.
That's the funny thing, though, is it could be. The technology is out there. We just haven't been using it.
It's true. Thank you so much for the call. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well, we have come to the end of the show, as we do every week. Amazing that, huh? Years of it, and it always ends. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Thank you, Miles, for joining me on GeekSpeak today.
Always a pleasure.
Everything we talk about on GeekSpeak, we'll even buffer bloat. I'll link an article to that as well. We'll be up at geekspeak.org. We'll be back next week, as we are every week, with your tech news of the week.